Welcome, the Dweller of the Dark. We are a channel honoring the yellowed and blackened bones of many prominent authors. We will be digging up several obscure, strange, and forgotten authors who influenced many of the great horror, science fiction, and fantasy writers to date. Comment below if you like. If you have authors that you'd like to see recognized, list them in the comments or contact our author page. Subscribe for more tales of the horrifying, obscure, strange, and forgotten. We'll have quite a collection climbing out of the tombs. If you like any of our tales, comment, ring the bell, and crush the like button below. Unknown Horror Masters, the Skull and Bones collection has risen from the grave. More beasts to be released soon. Find us on Fiverr to raise 7 kinds of hell. Check out our other stories and our websites. YouTube, BitChute, Rumble, Dweller of the Dark. Official website, dwellerofthedark.com. Kindle Vella, new serialized novels and novelette. Weekly new episodes. Check out links below for Where the Wolf Dwells. The Curious Death of Dionysus Chenault. Our books and ebooks are on Kindle Amazon. Follow, support us on Twitter, Instagram, Patreon, Bandcamp. Dweller of the Dark. Children of Horror. Legion of Ghouls. Tonight, we continue our celebration of Halloween. Each night, we will be presenting tales of the best Halloween horrors ever conjured to terrify, haunt, and delight. Wild Grapes by August Derleth. First published in Weird Tales, July 1934. A strange little story about the white cloud that hung over the unmarked grave of a murdered man. Weird Tales, July 1934. The echo of his neighbors' mocking voices lingered in Luke Adams' mind.
Wild Grapes!
Scornfully said, pityingly whispered from mouth to ear, from farm to farm, and on into Sac Prairie. Standing there on his rickety porch, he smiled, his grim lips curving only slightly, his eyes hard and cold. His gaze went from the farmyard across the fields to the clump of cedars fringing his land to the southwest. Dividing the trees from the fields were the wild grapes he had planted. He had planted them at night. Did those fools think of that? Not they. And the better for him. Darkness was a welcome cloak for his work, since the body could not have been handled in the daytime. Twilight did not obscure the strong green of the wild grapes. He considered them in the growing darkness, the long line of them curving along the slope, and finally drove his eyes to the thick clump growing where the body of his Uncle Rossa lay. He complimented himself again on the sagacity he had shown in setting wild grapes to grow on the spot where the body was buried. No expense had been incurred, and the broken earth on the edge of the field had excited no comment but the scornful voices of his farming neighbors, who thought him crazy to go to any trouble about wild grapes when there were so many of them in the bottoms not far from his land. He was glad, too, that the old man had the reputation for taking long and mysterious journeys and staying away for months at a time without communicating with anyone. All the old man's friends nodded solemnly
and said, "Rouse is gone on another tear." No one had suspected anything. Luke could appreciate the irony of their laughter over his wild grapes. The stars brightened, and the afterglow faded to a fan of emerald light flung upward against the western sky. Luke lit his pipe and watched the slow smoke trail upward from his lips. A whippoorwill began to call from the bottoms. Abruptly, a small dark shape dropped noiselessly to the roof of the corn crib and shrilled its flute-like call into the growing night. Luke thought of the legend about whippoorwills calling for a dying man's soul. He caught up a clod of earth and flung it at the bird on the corn crib.
"Get out," he muttered harshly. "You got Uncle Rousa. You don't get me."
He laughed at his words grimly. One by one, the whippoorwills assaulted the silence, and from the sky came the harsh calls of nighthawks and woodcocks. An owl hooted mournfully from the grove of cedars. Presently, the moon pushed itself into the sky above the low range of hills to the east, and long shadows haunted the ground. Thinking of his uncle, Luke experienced a shudder of irritation at himself that he had not killed the old man with one blow.
"Hell get you for this, Luke, and if they don't, I will,"
he had had time to say before that second blow, and he had cursed him too. Luke smiled, took his pipe from his mouth, and spat at a stone not far from the porch steps.
"Come on, Rousa," he murmured. "I'm still waiting."
He felt warmth creeping over him at the satisfactory knowledge of his ownership of his uncle's farm. He had always wanted it. Now it was his, even if the fools thereabouts considered him only a caretaker, when it would be plain to them that the old man was never coming back. Even they would have to acknowledge him as owner. He knocked out his pipe presently and stood up, stretching himself. Then he turned to go into the house. From the threshold, he looked once more toward the line of wild grapes, fixing his eyes on the large clump in the center, now lost against the dark background of the cedars. As he looked, he reflected that he had never before been aware of that patch of sky showing through between the trees above the grapevines. Even as he thought it, the sky moved gently to one side. For a breathless moment, Luke felt a shock of terror. Then he took a deep breath, pressed his lips firmly together, and stared long and hard at the patch of sky. The sky wavered a little, moved casually to the north, and drifted southward again.
It was not sky. It was a whiteness above the secret grave, standing out against the cedars, not sky showing through from beyond.
Luke flung himself into the house, banging the door behind him. and stood with his back against it. Sweat flecked his forehead and his hands shook despite his determination to control himself. He strove to convince himself that he had seen nothing, that his eyes and the night had combined to play a ghastly trick on him. Presently, he moved away from the door. He halted just before he reached the west window. Hesitation looped about his legs, stopping their advance. If he went forward, he would look out of the window. He would look at the grave, and his eyes might trick him again. He stood there, feeling that the house was pressing its walls toward him. A sense of ominous closeness enveloped him. Presently, he groped for the table, found the lamp and the box of matches. He struck one and held the dancing flame to the wick, his shadow grotesque against the wall and the ceiling. The small, poorly furnished room sprang into dubious life. A feeling of security returned to him with the light, and he sat down at the table, resting his head on his clenched fist. The noise of the whippoorwills dinned into the room. Insistence in the wealth of flute-like notes that welled across the fields from the lowlands and the marsh beyond. As he sat listening to them, unreasonable anger grew at their calls, and he determined to go whippoorwill hunting in the morning, intent upon paying them back for the fright he had got. The fear having gone completely out of him, he rose abruptly and strode boldly to the window. He looked out. The white mass had grown. It lowered threateningly above the row of wild grapes, uncanny movement breaking its outlines. As he looked, the moonlight faded suddenly, clouds blanketing it away from the earth, and the white shape against the cedars seemed to glow as if from some inner light. He fell back from the window, his heart pounding with maddening insistence. There was something at the grave. Terror possessed him suddenly, terror driven into fierce life at the fear that somehow Rausa Adam was coming back to get him, as the dead man had promised. He made a frantic calculation. It was almost a month now since he had killed the old man. No one had suspected. No one had come for him. No solid flesh could rise from that grave. Yet, the old man had said he would return if Luke. The door swung suddenly wide, forced open by a gust of wind, and the night gaped blackly beyond. Lamplight lit the porch floor tentatively, fingers of flickering light turned back by the darkness. Luke looked out through the doorway toward the southwest where the grave was. The white thing was still there, moving with the wind. Now this way, now that. And occasionally there were flapping white arms seeming to beckon him, or grotesque heads lolling horribly against the night. He dragged himself from the room to the porch, where he leaned against a post, looking with fear-maddened eyes toward the line of wild grapes. There was something about that whiteness, something that brought sudden hope to him. He stared, cold sweat smarting in his eyes. Then he remembered phosphorus from decaying bodies. He had read of that somewhere. It sometimes happened. So-called ghosts in graveyards were nothing but phosphorus. He remembered reading about it. He almost sobbed his relief and, for a moment, laughed weakly at himself. He tempered his relief with the thought that he had better make sure about the phosphorescence. Immediately, another thought occurred to him and brought apprehension. If it were phosphorescence, someone might possibly notice it and investigate. Though the spot was out of sight of all farmhouses and all roads save the poorly marked trail to his own house, and in sight of strange fields only during the day. He stepped from the porch, leaving the lamp-lit doorway open behind him, and strode away into the darkness, frightening up whippoorwills as he went. As he came into the Southwest 40, uneasiness took possession of him at recognition of the fact that the phosphorescence did not fade, that it seemed to have descended more closely about the clump of grapevines growing from the spot where the body lay concealed. He halted uncertainly 10 feet from the vines and looked. The whiteness was phosphorescence. He was sure of that. He felt vaguely that it ought by rights to be closer to the ground, but he could not be sure. And it moved oddly, sometimes with the wind, but sometimes not. There was a very odd shape to it, too. He felt misgivings and cast a glance backward for the reassuring sight of the rectangle of light from the house. Despite a sudden feeling that he should go no farther, he stepped forward. He came up to the mass of vines and looked carefully down at the unmarked spot where he had nocturnally buried Rousa Adam almost a month ago. The ground seemed oddly broken. He pushed away the grapevines and peered closer. Suddenly, he felt something close about his ankle, felt something whip toward his uncovered head. He jerked upward and felt his arms too caught. Then he looked up. His hoarse, terror-fraught screams were muffled by the writhing mass of grapevines which descended upon him, their rustling like an echo of Rosa Adams' dying voice, their sentient movement vengefully alive. He was found 2 mornings after. He had been strangled. There were still vines wound oddly about his throat. It was said in Sac Prairie that he had probably entangled himself somehow and had caused his death. Everybody said it served him right. In his struggles, he had kicked up the ground so that the body of Rosa Adam was discovered. The farmers who dug the old man out said he was not a pleasant sight. The big grapevine which Luke had planted above his victim had rooted itself firmly in the decaying flesh and clung fiercely to the body when they moved it. The Mortal, Immortal by Mary Shelley. July 16th, 1833. This is a memorable anniversary for me. On it, I complete my 323rd year. The Wandering Jew. Certainly not. More than 18 centuries have passed over his head. In comparison with him, I am a very young immortal. Am I, then, immortal? This is a question which I have asked myself by day and night. For now, 303 years, and yet cannot answer it. I detected a gray hair amidst my brown locks this very day. That surely signifies decay. Yet it may have remained concealed there for 300 years. For some persons have become entirely white-headed before 20 years of age. I will tell my story, and my reader shall judge for me. I will tell my story, and so contrive to pass some few hours of a long eternity become so wearisome to me. Forever can it be to live forever? I have heard of enchantments in which the victims were plunged into a deep sleep to wake after 100 years as fresh as ever. I've heard of the seven sleepers. Thus to be immortal would not be so burthensome. But oh, the weight of never-ending time, the tedious passage of the still succeeding hours. How happy was the fabled Nourjahad. But to my task. All the world has heard of Cornelius Agrippa. His memory is as immortal as his arts have made me. All the world has also heard of his scholar who, unawares, raised the foul fiend during his master's absence and was destroyed by him. The report, true or false, of this accident was attended with many inconveniences to be the renowned philosopher. All his scholars at once deserted him. His servants disappeared. He had no one near him to put coals on his ever-burning fires while he slept, or to attend to the changeful colors of his medicines while he studied. Experiment after experiment failed, because one pair of hands was insufficient to complete them. The dark spirits laughed at him for not being able to retain a single mortal in his service. I was then very young, very poor, and very much in love. I had been for about a year the pupil of Cornelius, though I was absent when this accident took place. On my return, my friends implored me not to return to the alchemist's abode. I trembled as I listened to the dire tale they told. I required no second warning. And when Cornelius came and offered me a purse of gold if I would remain under his roof, I felt as if Satan himself tempted me. My teeth chattered. My hair stood on end. I ran off as fast as my trembling knees would permit. My failing steps were directed whither, for 2 years, they had every evening been attracted, a gently bubbling spring of pure living waters, besides which lingered a dark-haired girl whose beaming eyes were fixed on the path I was accustomed each night to tread. I cannot remember the hour when I did not love Bertha. We had been neighbors and playmates from infancy. Her parents, like mine, were of humble life, yet respectable. Our attachment had been a source of pleasure to them. In an evil hour, a malignant fever carried off both her father and mother, and Bertha became an orphan. She would have found a home beneath my paternal roof, But, unfortunately, the old lady of the near castle, rich, childless, and solitary, declared her intention to adopt her. Henceforth, Bertha was clad in silk, inhabited a marble palace, and was looked on as being highly favored by fortune. But in her situation among her new associates, Bertha remained true to the friend of her humbler days. She often visited the cottage of my father, and when forbidden to go thither, she would stray towards the neighboring wood and meet me beside its shady fountain. She often declared that she owed no duty to her protectress equal in sanctity to that which bound us. Yet still, I was too poor to marry, and she grew weary of being tormented on my account. She had a haughty but an impatient spirit and grew angry at the obstacles that prevented our union. We met now after an absence, and she had been sorely beset while I was away. She complained bitterly and almost reproached me for being poor. I replied hastily, "I am honest if I am poor. Were I not, I might soon become rich." This exclamation produced 1,000 questions. I feared to shock her by owning the truth, but she drew it from me, and then casting a look of disdain on me, she said, "You pretend to love, and you fear to face the devil for my sake." I protested that I had only dreaded to offend her, while she dwelt on the magnitude of the reward that I should receive. Thus encouraged, shamed by her, led on by love and hope, laughing at my late fears, with quick steps and a light heart, I returned to accept the offers of the alchemist and was instantly installed in my office. A year passed away. I became possessed of no insignificant sum of money. Custom had banished my fears. In spite of the most painful vigilance, I had never detected the trace of a cloven foot, nor was the studious silence of our abode ever disturbed by demoniac howls. I still continued my stolen interviews with Bertha, and hope dawned on me, hope, but not perfect joy. For Bertha fancied that love and security were enemies, and her pleasure was to divide them in my bosom. Though true of heart, she was somewhat of a coquette in manner, and I was jealous as a Turk. She slighted me in 1,000 ways, yet would never acknowledge herself to be in the wrong. She would drive me mad with anger, then force me to beg her pardon. Sometimes she fancied that I was not sufficiently submissive, and then she had some story of a rival. Favored by her protectress, she was surrounded by silk-clad youths, the rich and gay. What chance had the sad-robed scholar of Cornelius compared with these? On one occasion, the philosopher made such large demands upon my time that I was unable to meet her as I was wont. He was engaged in some mighty work, and I was forced to remain day and night, feeding his furnaces and watching his chemical preparations. Bertha waited for me in vain at the fountain. Her haughty spirit fired at this neglect. And when at last I stole out during the few short minutes allotted to me for slumber and hoped to be consoled by her, she received me with disdain, dismissed me in scorn, and vowed that any man should possess her hand rather than he who could not be in two places at once for her sake. She would be revenged, and truly she was. In my dingy retreat, I heard that she had been hunting, attended by Albert Hoffer. Albert Hoffer was favored by her protectress,
and the three passed in cavalcade before my smoky window. Methought they mentioned my name. It was followed by a laugh of derision as her dark eyes glanced contemptuously towards my abode. Jealousy, with all its venom and all its misery, entered my breast. Now I shed a torrent of tears to think that I should never call her mine, and anon I imprecated 1,000 curses on her inconstancy. Yet still I must stir the fires of the alchemist, still attend on the changes of his unintelligible medicines. Cornelius had watched for 3 days and nights, nor closed his eyes. Progress of his alembics was slower than he expected. In spite of his anxiety, sleep weighed upon his eyelids. Again and again, he threw off drowsiness with more than human energy. Again and again, it stole away his senses. He eyed his crucibles wistfully. "Not ready yet," he murmured. "Will another night pass before the work is accomplished? Winsy, you are vigilant. You are faithful. You have slept, my boy. You slept last night. Look at that glass vessel. The liquid it contains is of a soft rose color. The moment it begins to change its hue, awaken me. Till then, I may close my eyes. First, it will turn white and then emit golden flashes. But wait not till then. When the rose color fades, rouse me." I scarcely heard the last words muttered as they were in sleep. Even then, he did not quite yield to nature. "Winsy, my boy," he again said, "do not touch the vessel. Do not put it to your lips. It is a filter to cure love. You would not cease to love your Bertha. Beware to drink." And he slept, his venerable head sunk on his breast, and I scarce heard his regular breathing. For a few minutes, I watched the vessel. The rosy hue of the liquid remained unchanged. Then my thoughts wandered. They visited the fountain and dwelt on 1,000 charming scenes never to be renewed. Never! Serpents and adders were in my heart as the word "never" half formed itself on my lips. False girl, false and cruel. Nevermore would she smile on me as that evening she smiled on Albert. Worthless, detested woman. I would not remain unrevenged. She should see Albert expire at her feet. She should die beneath my vengeance. She had smiled in disdain and triumph. She knew my wretchedness and her power. Yet, what power had she? The power of exciting my hate? My utter scorn? My, all but indifference? Could I attain that? Could I regard her with careless eyes, transferring my rejected love to one fairer and more true? That were indeed a victory. A bright flash darted before my eyes. I had forgotten the medicine of the adept. I gazed on it with wonder. Flashes of admirable beauty, more bright than those which the diamond emits when the sun's rays are on it, glanced from the surface of the liquid. An odor, the most fragrant and grateful, stole over my sense. The vessel seemed one globe of living radiance, lovely to the eye, and most inviting to the taste. The first thought instinctively, inspired by the grosser sense, was, "I will, I must drink." I raised the vessel to my lips. "It will cure me of love, of torture." Already, I had quaffed half of the most delicious liquor ever tasted by the palate of man. When the philosopher stirred, I started. I dropped the glass. The fluid flamed and glanced along the floor while I felt Cornelius's gripe at my throat as he shrieked aloud, "Wretch, you have destroyed the labor of my life." The philosopher was totally unaware that I had drunk any portion of his drug. His idea was, and I gave a tacit assent to it, that I had raised the vessel from curiosity and that, frighted at its brightness and the flashes of intense light it gave forth, I had let it fall. I never undeceived him. The fire of the medicine was quenched. The fragrance died away. He grew calm, as a philosopher should, under the heaviest trials, and dismissed me to rest. I will not attempt to describe the sleep of glory and bliss which bathed my soul in paradise during the remaining hours of that memorable night. Words would be faint and shallow types of my enjoyment, or of the gladness that possessed my bosom when I woke. I trod air, my thoughts were in heaven. Earth appeared heaven, and my inheritance upon it was to be one trance of delight. "This it is to be cured of love," I thought. "I will see Bertha this day, and she will find her lover cold and regardless. Too happy to be disdainful, yet how utterly indifferent to her!" The hours danced away. The philosopher, secure that he had once succeeded and believing that he might again, began to concoct the same medicine once more. He was shut up with his books and drugs, and I had a holiday. I dressed myself with care. I looked in an old but polished shield, which served me for a mirror. Methought my good looks had wonderfully improved. I hurried beyond the precincts of the town, joy in my soul, the beauty of heaven and earth around me. I turned my steps toward the castle. I could look on its lofty turrets with lightness of heart, for I was cured of love. My Bertha saw me afar off as I came up the avenue. I know not what sudden impulse animated her bosom, but at the sight she sprung with a light fawn-like bound down the marble steps and was hastening towards me. But I had been perceived by another person, the old high-born hag who called herself her protectress and was her tyrant, had seen me also. She hobbled, panting, up the terrace. A page, as ugly as herself, held up her train and fanned her as she hurried along and stopped my fair girl with a, "How now, my bold mistress? Whither so fast? Back to your cage. Hawks are abroad." Bertha clasped her hands. Her eyes were still bent on my approaching figure. I saw the contest, how I abhorred the old crone who checked the kind impulses of my Bertha's softening heart. Hitherto, respect for her rank had caused me to avoid the lady of the castle. Now I disdained such trivial considerations. I was cured of love and lifted above all human fears. I hastened forwards and soon reached the terrace. How lovely Bertha looked! her eyes flashing fire, her cheeks glowing with impatience and anger. She was 1,000 times more graceful and charming than ever. I no longer loved. Oh, no, I adored, worshipped, idolized her. She had that morning been persecuted with more than usual vehemence to consent to an immediate marriage with my rival. She was reproached with the encouragement that she had shown him. She was threatened with being turned out of doors with disgrace and shame. Her proud spirit rose in arms at the threat, but when she remembered the scorn that she had heaped upon me and how, perhaps, she had thus lost one whom she now regarded as her only friend, she wept with remorse and rage. At that moment, I appeared. "Oh, Winsy," she exclaimed. "Take me to your mother's cot. Swiftly, let me leave the detested luxuries and wretchedness of this noble dwelling. Take me to poverty and happiness." I clasped her in my arms with transport. The old lady was speechless with fury and broke forth into invective only when we were far on our road to my natal cottage. My mother received the fair fugitive, escaped from a guilt cage to nature and liberty, with tenderness and joy. My father, who loved her, welcomed her heartily. It was a day of rejoicing, which did not need the addition of the celestial potion of the alchemist to steep me in delight. Soon after this eventful day, I became the husband of Bertha. I ceased to be the scholar of Cornelius, but I continued his friend. I always felt grateful to him for having unawares procured me that delicious draught of a divine elixir, which, instead of curing me of love, sad cure, solitary and joyless remedy for evils, which seems blessings to the memory, had inspired me with courage and resolution, thus winning for me an inestimable treasure in my Bertha. I often call to mind that period of trance-like inebriation with wonder. The drink of Cornelius had not fulfilled the task for which he affirmed that it had been prepared, but its effects were more potent and blissful than words can express. They had faded by degrees, yet they lingered long and painted life in hues of splendor. Bertha often wondered at my lightness of heart and unaccustomed gaiety, for before I had been rather serious or even sad in my disposition. She loved me the better for my cheerful temper, and our days were winged by joy. 5 years afterwards, I was suddenly summoned to the bedside of the dying Cornelius. He had sent for me in haste, conjuring my instant presence. I found him stretched on his pallet, enfeebled even to death. All of life that yet remained animated his piercing eyes, and they were fixed on a glass vessel full of a roseate liquid. "Behold," he said in a broken and inward voice, "the vanity of human wishes. Second time my hopes are about to be crowned. A second time they are destroyed. Look at that liquor. You remember 5 years ago I had prepared the same with the same success. Then, as now, my thirsting lips expected to taste the immortal elixir. You dashed it from me, and at present it is too late." He spoke with difficulty and fell back on his pillow. I could not help saying, How, revered master, can a cure for love restore you to life? A faint smile gleamed across his face as I listened earnestly to his scarcely intelligible answer.
A cure for love and for all things. The elixir of immortality. Ah! If now I might drink, I should live forever.
As he spoke, a golden flash gleamed from the liquid. A well-remembered fragrance stole over the air. He raised himself, all weak as he was. Strength seemed miraculously to re-enter his frame. He stretched forth his hand. A loud explosion startled me. A ray of fire shot up from the elixir, and the glass vessel which contained it was shivered to atoms. I turned my eyes towards the philosopher. He had fallen back. His eyes were glassy, his features rigid. He was dead. But I lived, and was to live forever. So said the unfortunate alchemist. And for a few days, I believed his words. I remembered the glorious drunkenness that had followed my stolen draught. I reflected on the change I had felt in my frame, in my soul. The bounding elasticity of the one, the buoyant lightness of the other. I surveyed myself in a mirror and could perceive no change in my features during the space of the 5 years which had elapsed. I remembered the radiant hues and grateful scent of that delicious beverage, worthy the gift it was capable of bestowing. I was then immortal. A few days after I laughed at my credulity, the old proverb that a prophet is least regarded in his own country was true with respect to me and my defunct master. I loved him as a man. I respected him as a sage, but I derided the notion that he could command the powers of darkness and laughed at the superstitious fears with which he was regarded by the vulgar. He was a wise philosopher, but had no acquaintance with any spirits but those clad in flesh and blood. His science was simply human, and human science, I soon persuaded myself, could never conquer nature's laws so as to imprison the soul forever within its carnal habitation. Cornelius had brewed a soul-refreshing drink, more inebriating than wine, sweeter and more fragrant than any fruit. It possessed probably strong medicinal powers, imparting gladness to the heart and vigor to the limbs, but its effects would wear out. Already were they diminished in my frame. I was a lucky fellow to have quaffed health and joyous spirits, and perhaps long life, at my master's hands, but my good fortune ended there. Longevity was far different from immortality. I continued to entertain this belief for many years. Sometimes a thought stole across me. Was the alchemist indeed deceived? But my habitual credence was that I should meet the fate of all the children of Adam at my appointed time, a little late, but still at a natural age. Yet it was certain that I retained a wonderfully youthful look. I was laughed at for my vanity in consulting the mirror so often, but I consulted it in vain. My brow was untrenched, my cheeks, my eyes, my whole person continued as untarnished as in my 20th year. I was troubled. I looked at the faded beauty of Bertha. I seemed more like her son. By degrees, our neighbors began to make similar observations, and I found at last that I went by the name of the scholar bewitched. Bertha herself grew uneasy, She became jealous and peevish, and at length she began to question me. We had no children. We were all in all to each other, and though as she grew older, her vivacious spirit became a little allied to ill temper, and her beauty sadly diminished. I cherished her in my heart as the mistress I had idolized, the wife I had sought and won with such perfect love. At last, our situation became intolerable. Bertha was 50, I 20 years of age. I had, in very shame, in some measure adopted the habits of a more advanced age. I no longer mingled in the dance among the young and gay, but my heart bounded along with them while I restrained my feet. In a sorry figure I cut among the nesters of our village. But before the time I mentioned, things were altered. We were universally shunned. We were, at least, I was, reported to have kept up an iniquitous acquaintance with some of my former master's supposed friends. Poor Bertha was pitied, but deserted. I was regarded with horror and detestation. What was to be done? We sat by our winter fire. Poverty had made itself felt, for none would buy the produce of my farm, and often I had been forced to journey 20 miles to some place where I was not known to dispose of our property. It is true, we had saved something for an evil day. That day was come. We sat by our lone fireside, the old-hearted youth and his antiquated wife. Again, Bertha insisted on knowing the truth. She recapitulated all she had ever heard said about me and added her own observations. She conjured me to cast off the spell. She described how much more comely gray hairs were than my chestnut locks. She descanted on the reverence and respect due to age, how preferable to the slight regard paid to mere children. Could I imagine that the despicable gifts of youth and good looks outweighed disgrace, hatred, and scorn? Nay, in the end, I should be burnt as a dealer in the black art, while she, to whom I had not deigned to communicate any portion of my good fortune, might be stoned as my accomplice. At length, she insinuated that I must share my secret with her and bestow on her like benefits to those I myself enjoyed, or she would denounce me, and then she burst into tears. Thus beset, methought it was the best way to tell the truth. I revealed it as tenderly as I could, and spoke only of a very long life, not of immortality, which representation, indeed, coincided best with my own ideas. When I ended, I rose and said, "And now, my Bertha, will you denounce the lover of your youth? You will not, I know. But it is too hard, my poor wife, that you should suffer from my ill luck and the accursed arts of Cornelius. I will leave you. You have wealth enough, and friends will return in my absence. I will go, young as I seem, and strong as I am. I can work and gain my bread among strangers, unsuspected and unknown. I loved you in youth. God is my witness that I would not desert you in age, but that your safety and happiness require it. I took my cap and moved towards the door. In a moment, Bertha's arms were round my neck and her lips were pressed to mine. "No, my husband, my Winsy," she said. "You shall not go alone. Take me with you. We will remove from this place, and, as you say, among strangers, we shall be unsuspected and safe. I am not so very old as quite to shame you, my Winsy, and I dare say the charm will soon wear off, and, with the blessing of God, you will become more elderly looking, as is fitting. You shall not leave me." I return the good soul's embrace heartily. "I will not, my Bertha, but for your sake, I had not thought of such a thing. I will be your true, faithful husband while you are spared to me, and do my duty by you to the last." The next day, we prepared secretly for our emigration. We were obliged to make great pecuniary sacrifices. Could not be helped. We realized the sum sufficient at least to maintain us while Bertha lived, and, without saying adieu to anyone, quitted our native country to take refuge in a remote part of Western France. It was a cruel thing to transport poor Bertha from her native village and the friends of her youth to a new country, new language, new customs. The strange secret of my destiny rendered this removal immaterial to me. But I compassionated her deeply and was glad to perceive that she found compensation for her misfortunes in a variety of little, ridiculous circumstances. Away from all telltale chroniclers, she sought to decrease the apparent disparity of our ages by 1,000 feminine arts, rouge, youthful dress, and assumed juvenility of manner. I could not be angry. Did not I myself wear a mask? Why quarrel with hers? Because it was less successful? I grieved deeply when I remembered that this was my Bertha, whom I had loved so fondly, and won with such transport, the dark-eyed, dark-haired girl, smiles of enchanting archness and a step like a fawn. This mincing, simpering, jealous old woman. I should have revered her gray locks and withered cheeks. But thus, it was my work, I knew. But I did not the less deplore this type of human weakness. Her jealousy never slept. Her chief occupation was to discover that, in spite of outward appearances, I was myself growing old. I verily believe that the poor soul loved me truly in her heart, but never had woman so tormenting a mode of displaying fondness. She would discern wrinkles in my face and decrepitude in my walk, while I bounded along in youthful vigor, the youngest looking of 20 youths. I never dared address another woman. On one occasion, fancying that the belle of the village regarded me with favoring eyes, she bought me a gray wig. Her constant discourse among her acquaintances was that though I looked so young, there was ruin at work within my frame, and she affirmed that the worst symptom about me was my apparent health. My youth was a disease, she said, and I ought at all times to prepare, if not for a sudden and awful death, at least to awake some morning white-headed and bowed down with all the marks of advanced years. I let her talk. I often joined in her conjectures. Her warnings chimed in with my never-ceasing speculations concerning my state. And I took an earnest, though painful, interest in listening to all that her quick wit and excited imagination could say on the subject. Why dwell on these minute circumstances? We lived on for many long years. Bertha became bedridden and paralytic. I nursed her as mother might a child. She grew peevish and still harped upon one string of how long I should survive her. It has ever been a source of consolation to me that I performed my duty scrupulously towards her. She had been mine in youth. She was mine in age. And at last, when I heaped the sod over her corpse, I wept to feel that I had lost all that really bound me to humanity. Since then, how many have been my cares and woes? How few and empty my enjoyments? I pause here in my history. I will pursue it no further. A sailor without rudder or compass, tossed on a stormy sea. A traveler lost on a widespread heath, without landmark or star to him. Such have I been. More lost, more hopeless than either. A nearing ship, a gleam from some far cot may save them, but I have no beacon except the hope of death. Death, mysterious, ill-visaged, friend of weak humanity. Why alone of all mortals have you cast me from your sheltering fold? Oh, for the peace of the grave, the deep silence of the iron-bound tomb. That thought would cease to work in my brain, and my heart beat no more, with emotions varied only by new forms of sadness. Am I immortal? I return to my first question. In the first place, is it not more probable that the beverage of the alchemist was fraught rather with longevity than eternal life? Such is my hope. And then be it remembered that I only drink half of the potion prepared by him. Was not the whole necessary to complete the charm? To have drained half the elixir of immortality is but to be half immortal. My forever is thus truncated and null. But again, who shall number the years of the half of eternity? I often try to imagine by what rule the infinite may be divided. Sometimes I fancy age advancing upon me. One gray hair I have found. Fool! Do I lament? Yes. The fear of age and death often creeps coldly into my heart. And the more I live, the more I dread death, even while I abhor life. Such an enigma is man, born to perish, when he wars, as I do, against the established laws of his nature. But for this anomaly of feeling surely I might die, the medicine of the alchemist would not be proof against fire, sword, and the strangling waters. I have gazed upon the blue depths of many a placid lake and the tumultuous rushing of many a mighty river, and have said, peace inhabits those waters. Yet I have turned my steps away to live yet another day. I've asked myself whether suicide would be a crime in one to whom thus only the portals of the other world could be opened. I have done all, except presenting myself as a soldier or duelist an object of destruction to my, no, not my fellow mortals, and therefore I have shrunk away. They are not my fellows. The inextinguishable power of life in my frame and their ephemeral existence place us wide as the poles asunder. I could not raise a hand against the meanest or the most powerful among them. Thus, I have lived on for many a year, alone, and weary of myself, desirous of death, yet never dying, a mortal, immortal. Neither ambition nor avarice can enter my mind, and the ardent love that gnaws at my heart, never to be returned, never to find an equal on which to expend itself, lives there only to torment me. This very day, I conceived the design by which I may end all, without self-slaughter, without making another man a Cain, an expedition which mortal frame can never survive, even endued with the youth and strength that inhabits mine. Thus, I shall put my immortality to the test and rest forever, or return the wonder and benefactor of the human species. Before I go, a miserable vanity has caused me to pen these pages. I would not die and leave no name behind. 3 centuries have passed since I quaffed the fatal beverage. Another year shall not elapse before encountering gigantic dangers, warring with the powers of frost in their home, beset by famine, toil, and tempest. I yield this body, too tenacious a cage for a soul which thirsts for freedom, to the destructive elements of air and water. Or, if I survive, my name shall be recorded as one of the most famous among the sons of men. And my task achieved, I shall adopt more resolute means, and by scattering and annihilating the atoms that compose my frame, set at liberty the life imprisoned within, and so cruelly prevent it from soaring from this dim earth to a sphere more congenial to its immortal essence. The Singular Death of Morton by Algernon Blackwood. Dusk was melting into darkness as the two men slowly made their way through the dense forest of spruce and fir that clothed the flanks of the mountain. They were weary with the long climb, for neither was in his first youth, and the July day had been a hot one. Their little inn lay further in the valley, among the orchards that separated the forest from the vineyards. Neither of them talked much. The big man led the way, carrying the knapsack, and his companion, older, shorter, evidently the more fatigued of the two, followed with small footsteps. From time to time, he stumbled among the loose rocks. An exceptionally observant mind would possibly have divined that his stumbling was not entirely due to fatigue, but to an absorption of spirit that made him careless how he walked. "All right behind?" the big man would call from time to time, half glancing back. "Hey, what?" the other would reply, startled, out of reverie.
Pace too fast?
Not a bit. I'm coming. And once he added, you might hurry on and see to supper. If you feel like it, I shan't be long behind you. But his big friend did not adopt the suggestion. He kept the same pace between them. He called out the same question at intervals. Once or twice, he stopped and looked back too. In this way, they came at length to the skirts of the wood. A deep hush covered all the valley. The limestone ridges they had climbed gleamed down white and ghostly upon them from the fading sky. Midway in its journeys, the evening wind dropped suddenly to watch the beauty of the moonlight, to hold the branches still so that the light might slip between and weave its silver pattern on the moss below. And as they stood a moment to take it in, a step sounded behind them on the soft pine needles, and the older man, still a little in the rear, turned with a start as though he had been suddenly called by name.
There's that girl again,
he said, and his voice expressed a curious mingling of pleasure, surprise, and apprehension. Into a patch of moonlight passed the figure of a young girl, looked at them as though about to stop, yet, thinking better of it, smiled softly and moved on out of sight into the surrounding darkness. The moon just caught her eyes and teeth so that they shone. The rest of her body stood in shadow. The effect was striking, almost as though head and shoulders hung alone in midair, watching them with this shining smile, then fading away.
Come on, for heaven's sake,
the big man cried. There was impatience in his manner, not unkindness. The other lingered a moment, peering closely into the gloom where the girl had vanished. His friend repeated his injunction, and a moment later the two had emerged upon the high road, with the village lights in sight beyond, and the forest left behind them like a vast mantle that held the night within its folds. For some minutes, neither of them spoke. Then, the big man waited for his friend to draw up alongside.
About all this valley of the Jura, he said presently, there seems to me something rather weird.
He shifted the knapsack vigorously on his back. It was a gesture of unconscious protest.
Something uncanny,
he added, as he set a good pace.
But extraordinarily beautiful.
It attracts you more than it does me, I think,
was the short reply.
The picturesque superstitions still survive here, observed the older man. They touched the imagination in spite of oneself.
A pause followed, during which the other tried to increase the pace. The subject evidently made him impatient for some reason.
Perhaps, he said presently, though I think myself it's due to the curious loneliness of the place. I mean, we're in the middle of tourist Europe here, yet so utterly remote. It's such a neglected little corner of the world. The contradiction bewilders. Then, being so near the frontier, too,
with the clock changing an hour a mile from the village. Makes one think of time as unreal and imaginary. He laughed. He produced several other reasons as well. His friend admitted their value and agreed half-heartedly. He still turned occasionally to look back. The mountain ridge where they had climbed was clearly visible in the moonlight. Odd, he said. But I don't see that farmhouse where we got the milk anywhere. It ought to be easily visible from here. Hardly in this light. It was a queer place, rather, I thought, he added. He did not deny the curiously suggestive atmosphere of the region. He merely wanted to find satisfactory explanations. A case in point, I mean. I didn't like it quite. That farmhouse. Yet I'm hanged if I know why. It made me feel uncomfortable. That girl appeared so suddenly, although the place seemed deserted, and her silence was so odd. Why in the world couldn't she answer a single question? I'm glad I didn't take the milk. I spat it out. I'd like to know where she got it from, for there was no sign of a cow or a goat to be seen anywhere. I swallowed mine, in spite of the taste, said the other, half smiling at his companion's sudden volubility. Very abruptly then, the big man turned and faced his friend. Was it merely an effect of the moonlight, or had his skin really turned pale beneath the sunburn? I say, old man, he said, his face grave and serious. What do you think she was? What made her seem like that? And why the devil do you think she followed us? I think, was the slow reply, it was me she was following. The words, and particularly the tone of conviction in which they were spoken, clearly were displeasing to the big man, who already regretted having spoken so frankly what was in his mind. With a companion so imaginative, so impressionable, so nervous, it had been foolish and unwise. He led the way home at a pace that made the other arrive 5 minutes in his rear, panting, limping, and perspiring as if he had been running. I'm rather for going on into Switzerland tomorrow or the next day, he ventured that night in the darkness of their two-bedded room. I think we've had enough of this place, eh? What do you think? But there was no answer from the bed across the room, for its occupant was sound asleep and snoring. Dead tired, I suppose, he muttered to himself, then turned over to follow his friend's example. But for a long time, sleep refused him. Queer, unwelcome thoughts and feelings kept him awake of a kind he rarely knew and thoroughly disliked. It was rubbish, yet made him uncomfortable so that his nerves tingled. He tossed about in the bed. I'm overtired, he persuaded himself. That's all. The strange feelings that kept him thus awake were not easy to analyze, perhaps, but their origin was beyond all question. They grouped themselves about the picture of that deserted, tumble-down chalet on the mountain ridge where they had stopped for refreshment a few hours before. It was a farmhouse dilapidated and dirty, and the name stood in big black letters against a blue background on the wall above the door. La Chenille. Yet not a living soul was to be seen anywhere about it. The doors were fastened, windows shuttered, chimneys smokeless, dirt, neglect, and decay everywhere in evidence. Then, suddenly, as they had turned to go, after much vain shouting and knocking at the door, a face appeared, for an instant, at a window, the shutter of which was half open. His friends saw it first and called aloud. The face nodded in reply, and presently a young girl came round the corner of the house, apparently by a back door, and stood staring at them both from a little distance. From that very instant, so far as he could remember, these queer feelings had entered his heart. Fear, distrust, misgiving. The thought of it now, as he lay in bed in the darkness, made his hair rise. There was something about that girl that struck cold into the soul. Yet, she was a mere slip of a thing, very pretty, seductive even, with a certain serpent-like fascination about her eyes and movements. And although she only replied to their questions as to refreshment with a smile, uttering no single word, she managed to convey the impression that she was a managing little person who might make herself very disagreeable if she chose. In spite of her undeniable charm, there was about her an atmosphere of something sinister. He himself did most of the questioning, but it was his older friend who had the benefit of her smile. Her eyes hardly ever left his face, and once she had slipped quite close to him and touched his arm. The strange part of it now seemed to him that he could not remember in the least how she was dressed or what was the coloring of her eyes and hair. It was almost as though he had felt rather than seen her presence. The milk. She produced a jug and two wooden bowls after a brief disappearance round the corner of the house. Was, well, it tasted so odd that he had been unable to swallow it and had spat it out. His friend, on the other hand, savage with thirst, had drunk his bowl to the last drop too quickly to taste it even. And while he drank, had kept his eyes fixed on those of the girl who stood close in front of him. And from that moment, his friend had somehow changed. On the way down, he said things that were unusual, talking chiefly about the chenille and the girl and the delicious, delicate flavor of the milk, yet all phrased in such a way that it sounded singular, unfamiliar, unpleasant even. Now that he tried to recall the sentences, the actual words evaded him, but the memory of the uneasiness and apprehension that caused him to feel remained. And night ever italicizes such memories. Then, to cap it all, the girl had followed them It was wholly foolish and absurd to feel the things he did feel. Yet there the feelings were. And what was the good of arguing? That girl frightened him. The change in his friend was in some way or other a danger signal. More than this, he could not tell. An explanation might come later, but for the present, his chief desire was to get away from the place and to get his friend away too. And on this thought, sleep overtook him heavily. The windows were wide open. Outside was a garden with a rather high enclosing wall. And at the far end, a gate that was kept locked because it led into private fields and so by a back way to the cemetery and the little church. When it was open, the guests of the inn made use of it and got lost in the network of fields and vines, for there was no proper route that way to the road or the mountains. They usually ended up prematurely in the cemetery and got back to the village by passing through the church, which was always open, or by knocking at the kitchen doors of the other houses and explaining their position. Hence, the gate was locked now to save trouble. After several hours of hot, unrefreshing sleep, the big man turned in his bed and woke. He tried to stretch, but couldn't, then sat up, panting, with a sense of suffocation. And by the faint starlight of the summer night, he saw next that his friend was up and moving about the room. Remembering that sometimes he walked in his sleep, he called to him gently.
"Morton, old chap," he said in a low voice, with a touch of authority in it. "Go back to bed. You've walked enough for one day."
And the figure, obeying, as sleepwalkers often will, passed across the room and disappeared among the shadows over his bed. The other plunged and burrowed himself into a comfortable position again for sleep. But the heat of the room, the shortness of the bed, and this tiresome interruption of his slumbers made it difficult to lose consciousness. Forced his eyes to keep shut and his body to cease from fidgeting. But there was something nibbling at his mind, like a spirit mouse that never permitted him to cross the frontier into actual oblivion. He slept with one eye open, as the saying is. Odors of hay and flowers and baked ground stole in through the open window. With them, too, came from time to time sounds, little sounds that disturbed him without being ever loud enough to claim definite attention. Perhaps, after all, he did lose consciousness for a moment when, suddenly, a thought came with a sharp rush into his mind and galvanized him once more into utter wakefulness. It amazed him that he had not grasped it before. It was this. The figure he had seen was not the figure of his friend. Alarm gripped him at once. Before he could think or argue, and a cold perspiration broke out all over his body. He fumbled for matches, couldn't find them. Then, remembering there was an electric light, he scraped the wall with his fingers and turned on the little white switch. In the sudden glare that filled the room, he saw instantly that his friend's bed was no longer occupied, and his mind, then acting instinctively without process of conscious reasoning, flew like a flash to their walk of the day, to the tumble-down chenille, the glass of milk, the odd behavior of his friend, and to the girl. At the same second, he noticed that the odor in the room, which hitherto he had taken to be the composite odor of fields, flowers, and night, was really something else. It was the odor of freshly turned earth. Immediately on the top of this discovery came another. Those slight sounds he had heard outside the window were not ordinary night sounds, the murmur of wind and insects. They were footsteps moving softly, stealthily down the little paths of crushed granite. He was dressed in wonderful short order, noticing as he did so that his friend's night garments lay upon the bed, and that he too had therefore dressed. Further, that the door had been unlocked and stood half an inch ajar. There was now no question that he had slept again. Between the present and the moment when he had seen the figure, there had been a considerable interval. A couple of minutes later, he had made his way cautiously downstairs and was standing on the garden path in the moonlight. And as he stood there, his mind filled with the stories the proprietor had told a few days before of the superstitions that still lived in the popular imagination and haunted this little remote pine-clad valley. The thought of that girl sickened him. The odor of newly turned earth remained in his nostrils and made his gorge rise. Utterly and vigorously, he rejected the monstrous fictions he had heard, yet for all that, could not prevent their touching his imagination as he stood there in the early hours of the morning, alone with night and silence. The spell was undeniable. Only a mind without sensibility could have ignored it. He searched the little garden from end to end. Empty! Opposite the high gate, he stopped, peering through the iron bars, wet with dew to his hands. Far across the intervening fields, he fancied something moved. A second later, he was sure of it. Something down there, to the right, beyond the trees, was astir. It was in the cemetery. And this definite discovery sent a shudder of terror and disgust through him from head to foot. He framed the name of his friend with his lips, yet the sound did not come forth. Some deeper instinct warned him to hold it back. Instead, after incredible efforts, he climbed that iron gate and dropped down into the soaking grass upon the other side. Then, taking advantage of all the cover he could find, he ran swiftly and stealthily towards the cemetery. On the way, without quite knowing why he did so, he picked up a heavy stick, and a moment later, he stood beside the low wall that separated the fields from the churchyard, stood and stared. There, beside the tombstones, with their hideous metal wreaths and crowns of faded flowers, he made out the figure of his friend. He was stooping, crouched down upon the ground. Behind him rose a couple of bushy yew trees, against the dark of which his form was easily visible. He was not alone. In front of him, bending close over him, it seemed, was another figure. A slight, shadowy, slim figure. This time, the big man found his voice and called aloud.
"Morton! Morton!" he cried. "What in the name of heaven are you doing? What's the matter?"
In the instant, his deep voice broke the stillness of the night with its clamor. The little figure, half hiding his friend, turned about and faced him. He saw a white face with shining eyes and teeth as the form rose. The moonlight painted it with its own strange pallor. It was weird, unreal, horrible. And across the mouth, downwards from the lips to the chin, ran a deep stain of crimson. The next moment, the figure slid with a queer, gliding motion toward the trees and disappeared among the yews and tombstones in the direction of the church. The heavy stick hurled, whirling after it, fell harmlessly halfway, knocking a metal cross from its perch upon an upright grave. And the man who had thrown it raced full speed towards the huddled up figure of his friend, hardly noticing the thin, wailing cry that rose trembling through the night air from the vanished form. Nor did he notice more particularly that several of the graves newly made showed signs of recent disturbance, and that the odor of turned earth he had noticed in the room grew stronger. All his attention was concentrated upon the figure at his feet.
"Morton, man, get up! Wake for God's sake! You've been walking in..."
Then the words died upon his lips. The unnatural attitude of his friend's shoulders and the way the head dropped back to show the neck struck him like a blow in the face. There was no sign of movement. He lifted the body up and carried it, all limp and unresisting, by ways he never remembered afterwards, back to the inn. It was all a dreadful nightmare, a nightmare that carried over its ghastly horror into waking life. He knew that the proprietor and his wife moved busily to and fro about the bed, and that in due course the village doctor was upon the scene, and that he was giving a muddled and feverish description of all he knew, telling how his friend was a confirmed sleepwalker and all the rest. But he did not realize the truth until he saw the face of the doctor as he straightened up from the long examination.
"Will you wake him?" he heard himself asking. "Or let him sleep it out until morning?"
And the doctor's expression, even before the reply came to confirm it, told him the truth.
"Ah, monsieur, your friend will not ever wake again, I fear. It is the heart, you see. Alas, it is sudden failure of the heart."
The final scenes in the little tragedy, which thus brought his holiday to so abrupt and terrible a close, need no description, being in no way essential to this strange story. There were one or two curious details, however, that came to light afterwards. One was that for some weeks before There had been signs of disturbance among newly made graves in the cemetery, which the authorities had been trying to trace to the nightly wanderings of the village madman in vain. And another, that the morning after the death, a trail of blood had been found across the church floor, as though someone had passed through from the back entrance to the front. A special service was held that very week to cleanse the holy building from the evil of that stain. For the villagers, deep in their superstitions, declared that nothing human had left that trail. Nothing could have made those marks but a vampire disturbed at midnight in its awful occupation among the dead. Apart from such idle rumors, however, the bereaved carried with him to this day certain other remarkable details which cannot be so easily dismissed. For he had a brief conversation with the doctor, it appears, that impressed him profoundly. And the doctor, an intelligent man, prosaic as granite into the bargain, had questioned him rather closely as to the recent life and habits of his dead friend. The account of their climb to the chenille he heard with an amazement he could not conceal. "But no such chalet exist," he said. "There is no chenille. Long time ago, 50 years or more, there was such a place, but it was destroyed by the authorities on account of the evil reputation of the people who lived there. They burnt it. Nothing remains today but a few bits of broken wall and foundation." "Evil reputation?" The doctor shrugged his shoulders. "Travelers, even peasants disappeared," he said. "An old woman lived there with her daughter, and poisoned milk was supposed to be used. But the neighborhood accused them of worse than ordinary murder."
"In what way?"
"Said the girl was a vampire," answered the doctor shortly. And, after a moment's hesitation, he added, turning his face away as he spoke,
"It was a curious thing, though. That tiny hole in your friend's throat, small as a pinprick, yet so deep. And the heart, did I tell you? Was almost completely drained of blood."
Thank you for listening. Have a great night.